Les colloques du Collège de France.
Nathalie comes from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology in Plön, in the northern part of Germany. She's going to tell us about understanding the evolution of natural syndromes to the length of development.
Good. So first of all, thank you very much, Denis, for inviting me to this colloquium. It has been very fun today, and I've learned already from all other organisms and talks today. Thank you all for bearing with me. So I'm last speaker, so I hope that you can master some last energy to listen to what I have to say. So as Denis said, I will talk about the evolution of natural syndromes through the lens of development. And I would like to start slightly broad by just telling you about the main question that motivates most of my work, and that is simply what explains diversification and novelties, or put into other words, why is there so much variation in the capacity to evolve among living taxa? And to illustrate this point, you can maybe consider on the one hand of the extreme the coelacanth, which has basically remained unchanged for millions, hundreds of millions of years, actually. And on the other end of the spectrum, you see the cichlid fish, which are a very good example for a very fast evolving, quick group of species that really came up with a lot of amazing novelties. And this, of course, is an academic question that I want to address, but it has also some implications for real-world problems. And so if you, for example, consider the challenges that we are facing with biodiversity loss, you could also see this as a problem with too little evolution happening if organisms, for example, don't keep up with the environmental challenges that they are facing. And on the other hand of the spectrum, again, there's also a problem if too much evolution is happening in too short amounts of time. So, for example, antibiotic resistance if bacteria are just too fast in evolving away from the challenges that we pose to them. So the concept that phrases this problem is evolvability, and that is the capacity of organisms to generate heritable adaptive variation. And that's what we're trying to understand. And if you think of the drivers and the main factors that determine evolvability, then you can think of external and internal factors. So external factors would be ecological opportunities, selective pressures that the ecology is setting, but there's also internal factors and internal drivers. And of course, one of the most important ones is the genomic makeup, because of course, genetic variation is at the heart of the generation of novel variation. But genetic variation alone is futile if it's not actually translated into actual phenotypic variation. And that is done by developmental systems. And so I think we need a research program that really tries to understand how variation comes about and how then that it's becoming selected and leads to evolvable organisms. And so my work is mostly using maybe a bit unexpectedly, but I want to try to convince you that it's actually a really good system to study evolvability, and that's these Mediterranean wall lizards of the genus Podarces. So it's a group of lizards that consists of, it's increasingly growing, but at the moment there's 28 described species of these wall lizards. And as you can see on these pictures here, they are very diverse, mostly in terms of coloration, color patterns, but also body size and body dimensions. There's a great amount of variation. And they have been challenging for evolutionary biologists actually already since the late 1800s, because it turned out to be very, very difficult to classify them into species, simply because there's so much divergence in the system, so evolution happening, but also so much convergence. So sometimes species that occur on different sides of the Mediterranean look strikingly similar, and that was very, very difficult to classify in the beginning. But for us now, this group offers a great playground to basically decipher the rules of evolution and how they diversify and come up with new novelties. But I'm not going to talk about all these species today. I will zoom in to a specific species and a specific problem that we have been studying for many years now, and that is how a certain novel phenotype actually arises. And I will today focus about the developmental origins of the syndrome, And unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about the consequences of this novel phenotype, because actually we have found out that it has a lot of consequences for the whole social stability once a new phenotype comes in. And I can encourage you to look up a recent paper that we've published on the syndrome, the consequences of the syndrome. So let me tell you a little bit about the species. So first I would like to introduce you to the common wall lizard, Podarces muralis. It's called the common wall lizard because you find it basically everywhere in Europe. So we're a very broad distribution from, well, Spain in the west to Turkey in the east. It's outside here in Paris, so it has a really broad distribution. And basically almost everywhere you find the species, they look a little bit like the representative here on the top right. So it's a relatively boring looking lizard, like that size, brown, not very distinct in any way. But if you go to Italy, specifically to Tuscany and the coast of Liguria, you find representatives of the very same species that look quite different. So probably to your eyes, even if you don't are specialized on lizards, you see that they're really very different from the ancestral type. And they differ in several different features. One is that they have a black ventral coloration and also a striking green dorsal coloration, which is the most striking phenotype. They have many blue spots on the side, which are actually UV reflectant. They also differ in terms of morphology, so they can be up to twice the size compared to the ancestral form. And their heads and skulls are much larger in size as well. And where they co-occur, the ancestral type and this derived type, there's also differences in terms of social dominance and aggression, with these green ones being much more dominant compared to the ancestral ones. So they systematically differ in coloration, morphology, and also behavior. And since it's many different traits that set these two types apart, we have termed this the nigriventris syndrome. And syndrome here should not be understood as a medical condition, but it simply describes the occurrence of several traits that go together in these. And the obvious question now is then, how did this ancestral form actually turn into this derived nigriventris syndrome? And so if we again for a second consider the traits that make up the nigriventris system, then you may first think that they do not share anything in particular. But for the developmentally informed audience, you may realize that what they actually share is they have, at least in part, an origin in a certain developmental cell type, and that's the neurocrest cells. So neurocrest cells are a transient cell type that is specific to vertebrates only, and it derives from the crest of the neural tube. That's where the name comes from. And then cells in the early embryos detach from the neural tube, the neurocrest cells detach, and then they migrate to different areas of the embryonic body, and there they differentiate and give rise to a number of different cell types. And among those cell types is, for example, the pigment cells that are giving the animals their coloration, the cartilage that make up the head skeleton, and also, for example, the chromaffin cells that sit on the adrenal glands and that are important for aggressive behavior, for example. And if you look at the schematic here with the neurocrest cell on top and then splitting, bifurcating, giving rise to different cell types, you can easily appreciate that if you change the regulation of early development of these neurocrest cells, it may have knock-on effects on all these other traits in concert. So the idea here is that something happened in the early development of neurocrest cells, and that then led to the co-evolution of all these syndrome traits together, that then facilitated the origin of the syndrome. And this idea, I do not want to take credit for this, because the idea was put forward first by Adam Wilkins, who had this explanation for a syndrome, a different syndrome, namely the domestication syndrome. So he also thought that neurocrest cells may be responsible for the co-occurrence of different traits that all domesticated mammals are sharing. So now I would like to take a step back and guide you through to some of our previous results that pointed towards neural crest cells. And then I will come back and talk a little bit about our developmental work that we have done recently. But first, I will show you three previous results that are pointing towards neural crest cells being causal for the evolution of the syndrome. Number one, I first need to tell you a bit more about the geographic setting and the details of the syndrome. So far, I have presented it as if it would be two different morphs, the ancestral and the nigriventris syndrome. But actually, there's continuous variation in between them, both on an individual scale. So there are lizards that are halfway in between. So they're a little bit green, a little bit black, a little bit aggressive in between. And also on a population level scale. So what you see here is a map of northwestern Italy. Every white circle is a population for which we have population level information on the average phenotype. And then we have smoothed the landscape to show the average score on the nigriventris ancestral scale. Okay, so what this shows is that the populations that have, on average, the most occurrence of this most extreme nigriventris phenotypes are the ones close to today's Rome, so that's the most extreme ones. And then from there, if you travel into the mountains, you get into territories where almost all individuals look like the ancestral phenotype. So there's a variation on a geographic scale. And we have reconstructed the evolutionary steps that have led to this distribution that we find now. So we have reconstructed... First I have to introduce one more complication or slash interesting feature of the system, and that is that we are dealing here with a single species, yet there's a very deep divide within that species. They are split into two different lineages. So one we call the Italian lineage, IT lineage, which is in central Italy, and towards France. There's another lineage that is called the Southern Alps lineage. The names don't matter, but they're very, very deep divided lineages that have a divergence time of more than 6 million years ago. So really genetically very, very different animals that meet in a hybrid zone. And what we could reconstruct is that the nigriventris phenotype, the syndrome, originated in the region of today's Rome, probably on an island. It's probably an island phenotype in the first place. And from there, it has spread and is currently still spreading along the coast here. And it has introgressed from one genetic lineage via a hybrid zone into a very distantly related genetic lineage and is still introgressing along the coast here. So they are still moving towards France, basically. And this gave us a very nice opportunity to genetically map the syndrome phenotype, because it's basically a genetic outcrossing experiment that has been performed for us by nature, and we could use that to map the phenotype. But the point I want to make here is that so we have this continuous distribution of the phenotypes, and what's interesting or what's important and relevant for the syndrome and for the neural crest cells in the syndrome is that the traits are very tightly integrated with one another, even when the syndrome is introgressing into this distantly related lineage. And this I could show you by just showing pairwise correlations between morphological and coloration traits. I've just picked a few here to just show you that there's really a very tight correlation among these traits in the central Italian lineage where the syndrome originated, but also in the hybrid zone. So even when it's introgressing, the traits remain integrated. And to say this in other words, a little bit easier. So there is no lizard that is black but not green. So all the traits always go together. Okay? And this is exactly in line with the syndrome idea of neural crest cells pulling them together, because the development is linking them strongly together. Therefore, you can't break them up. And even if they integrate, they don't. They're not broken up, the syndrome. So that's evidence number one that points towards a developmentally organized syndrome. Point number two, I already alluded to a little bit. We have done work to identify the genetic basis of the syndrome. I will not go to the details here, but I'm happy to answer questions if anyone wants more details. But just briefly, so we have done a lot of different genome-wide association studies and also FST outlier scans on different data sets, and we have come up with roughly 80 genes that are strongly associated with the syndrome. And we expected that it would not be a very simple genetic basis, since it's not a very simple phenotype, obviously, so it's a complex phenotype. But we found 80 genes that are very strongly associated with the syndrome. And if we look into details of what these genes are doing, what functions they have, then we find that roughly half of them are actually known regulators of neurocrest cell function and various different aspects of neurocrest cell function. And I just give you three examples here. So one of the strongly associated genes is called GPC3. That is one gene that has been identified as being a trailblazer gene, so it's important for neurocrest cell migration. RBM10 is regulating neurocrest cell proliferation, so the aspect of division of neurocrest cells. And then one other transcription factor that's important for switching between the stem cell stage and the differentiation of neurocrest cells. So we think also the genomic basis points towards neurocrest cells being causal. The third and final piece of evidence comes from a morphological study that we have done. So I told you already that neurocrest cells make up part of the craniofacial skeleton of lizards, of vertebrates, not just lizards. And here you just get headshots of what ancestral and what a derived nigriventris skull looks like at the actual animal. And we have done micro-CT scanning of skulls of the most extreme phenotypes. And then we have compared the morphological variation between them. And the nice thing about the skull is that it's almost a 50-50 contribution between neurocrest cells that contribute to the skull to the frontal part and mesodermal cells that contribute to the more posterior part of the skull. It's not entirely clean like that, but roughly you can think like that. And what we have done is that we've compared the difference between the front part and the hind part between these two different forms. Oh, sorry, let me rephrase this and I show you the result and it's easier. So we have for the neurocrest derived modules, so for the front part, we have looked at the distance between the ancestor and the nigriventris. And for the mesodermal part, we have done the same and we find that only in the front part, there's a strong divergence between the two different forms, between the ancestral and the nigriventris form. So the neurocrest-derived part is what's evolving, what's changing, while the mesodermal part is basically conserved and not changing between the two different forms. So again, this is also consistent with neurocrest cells playing a role in the divergence between these two different forms. So I hope this convinced you that neurocrest cells are playing a role in the evolution of the syndrome. It at least convinced us to embark on some more developments in biology and dig deeper into how exactly neurocrest cells shape the syndrome. And enter Robin Pranter, who was a PhD student, very brave, who took on this project. And he came up with a very specific hypothesis that he followed up, and that is that there's actually a hyperfunction in neurocrest cells that's causing the nigriventris syndrome. So neurocrest cells in nigriventris phenotypes do something more and more exaggerated to come up with this exaggerated phenotype. And he really zoomed into embryos, cells, and transcriptional programs in cells to try and follow up this hypothesis. And he broke this down into three specific aspects that may underlie this hyperfunction. And these are, one, it could be the number of neurocrest cells. So nigriventris embryos could just have more or more proliferative neurocrest cells. Number two, it could be that something in the migration of these cells differs. So the neurocrest cells are just more able to migrate and therefore they arrive earlier and differentiate more, for example. Or the last point was that it could be the same number of neurocrest cells and they migrate in the same way, but they differ in their transcriptional profile. Okay, so that was the a priori predictions that he came up with. And these three are, of course, not mutually exclusive. All of the three could apply in principle. So what Robin has done, he came up with a method that allowed him to test these predictions. And the method starts with lizard embryos, obviously, and he wanted to study their cellular behavior. So he needed a method that allows him to get to neurocrest cells. And since they are distributed across the embryo, there's no way of microdissecting them. So he came up with a cell sorting approach. So he used an antibody that recognizes neurocrest cells, HNK1. And then he used FACS sorting to specifically enrich for HNK1 positive cells, putative neurocrest cells. And then we used single cell RNA sequencing. And the specific design that he applied was, of course, he wanted to contrast the extreme phenotypes. So he used embryos derived from ancestral phenotype parents and from nigriventris phenotype parents. And he looked at three different developmental time points since we didn't know when the differences would be most pronounced. So then I jump right to what he came up with. So this is still all very much work in progress, but I can show you what we have done so far. So we have used, we have come up with a data set of 29 embryos across these developmental stages between the two different phenotypes. And we've, so far we have identified more or less to some detail 12 different cell types. And you can see here on the lower right, what we call a supercluster. And of that, we are very sure that these are really proper neurocrest cells. And we have done some more work now that even identifies that one half is the cranial part. The right part is the cranial, no, sorry, the left part is the cranial part, Hox negative, and the right part is mesenchymal, so the trunk. So it's the trunk part that has more neuronal cell types. And in the middle, it's mostly young neurocrest cells that then stream out to the both sides of the supercluster. And we're less sure about the peripheral cell types, and they could be off target potentially, so not necessarily neurocrest cells, but we're still investigating that. Yeah, and so with the clustering, one thing that was very reassuring for us and that made us very happy is that we get a clustering by cell type, similar to what has been shown by other people today, and not a clustering by developmental stage or phenotype, for example. So this is really very nice and reassuring. But I won't talk more about like what's exactly in these different cell clusters, but I will zoom out now and just tell you what we have done to specifically address these hypotheses that Robin has set up, the abundance, migration, and transcriptional state. So we have looked at the difference in abundance proliferation in several different ways. The one that I think is most straightforward is to use a specific score that we can assign to every single cell. It's called a T2M score that classifies if a cell is currently in a dividing state or not. So by that, we can identify which cells are actually actively dividing at the moment. And if we compare all cells that derive from the nigriventris phenotype to the ancestral phenotype, we find that the nigriventris-derived cells are much more likely to be in this T2M score relative to the ancestral embryos. So this is a very clean result that the nigriventris neurocrest cells are really much more proliferative compared to the ancestral phenotype, and that's in line with our prediction, or our idea, I should say. The second aspect that we looked at is migration, and that is still very much work in progress, but one way how we have tackled this is to simply assign cells to pre-migratory, migratory, or post-migratory. And then we look at the relative abundance of cells in these three different categories that we broadly categorized. And the cell numbers are unequal, but if we look what would be expected, then we can see if we focus on the migratory cell types, so the cell types that are actively in migration right now, then we see that they're always more abundant in the nigriventris-derived cells compared to the ancestral cells. So again, here it looks like that the nigriventris neurocrest cells are more likely to be in a migratory state. And lastly, the last thing we tested, I said, was the transcriptional profile. And we approached this by looking for each of our 12 different clusters, what genes are differentially expressed between ancestral-derived cells and nigromantid-derived cells. And again, a very clean result, but we still try to wrap our head around that, is that in at least four of the clusters, or at least three, I should say, we find a very, very clear pattern that many, many genes are upregulated in nigromantid cells, but only very few are upregulated in ancestral cells. And we're still trying to understand where that result comes from. We have done some methodological tests and normalization tests, but this seems really hard to interpret at the moment. So I'm happy to hear any ideas if anyone has any interpretations of that. But at least it seems like nigromantid neurocrest cells have an elevated gene expression relative to ancestral-derived cell types. So to go back to Robin's initial hypothesis, so he hypothesized that there's a hyperfunction of neurocrest cells in nigromantid embryos relative to ancestral embryos. It seems like all the three alternative mechanisms that he thought about have some positive evidence that we find. So this is very encouraging and is also, as I said, in line with our previous results that pointed already towards neurocrest cells. So we are really excited about these results. But as I said, it's very much work in progress. So we're still very much on the go of work, making this more tight and more waterproof and test some more potential pitfalls. Good. So with this, I would like to come back to what I talked about in the beginning. So I started the talk by saying that the most interesting, in my opinion, is to try and find out what makes organisms evolvable and what are the factors that contribute to evolvability. And I hope that I've convinced you that the developmental processes and just how developmental cell types arise can very much structure phenotypic variation, and that this can then influence evolution and evolutionary outcomes. So that's why some syndrome traits are much more likely to develop and evolve together rather than other traits that have a very distinct developmental trajectory. And this is, of course, a specific case study in a lizard on a specific syndrome, but I believe that it can have more broader implications also for other natural syndromes and for general other developmental biases. And with that, I want to just make sure that I thank everyone in the team. So this work, as I said, it was mostly Robin's PhD project that I talked about, and long-term collaborator Tobias Uller has also contributed a lot to these findings. And the whole team has come up with many different ideas and checks throughout the year. So I'm very grateful to all of them. Very happy also that I received generous funding that made all this possible. And lastly, I want to do two commercials. One is that if you are interested in these ideas of how we could link developmental biology and evolutionary biology, I would like to recommend a book that we published last year that is called Evolution Evolving, that spells out some of these ideas in more detail. And I have to skip this. And also I would like to invite everyone to join a workshop that we're organizing in autumn, 12th and to 14th of October in Plön at our institute. And there, for example, you could hear again Henrik talk about his work if you haven't gotten enough of that. And the deadline is quickly approaching, but there may be an extension of the deadline coming up. And with that, I would like to close, and I'm happy to take questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.